So he very much wants that international intervention. He just doesn't want critiques or conservation projects or anything that might limit what his government wants to do.
So talk about the trade deal between the European Union and Brazil and what it would mean for the rainforest. The United States, Trump is a close ally of Bolsonaro and fellow climate change denier, of course.
Well, of course. Yes, and in recent years, Brazil has had a much stronger economic relationship with Europe in terms of exporting different products, commodities, beef, also soy, in order to feed beef. And that relationship continues. Under Bolsonaro, there is a reorientation of Brazilian foreign policy towards the United States, and that is very much based in the sort of affinity that Bolsonaro feels with Trump. And of course, Bolsonaro is called the Trump of the tropics in some cases. And when, as we look at the specifics of what's happening in Brazil and the policies and basically the way Bolsonaro has acted since he became president at the beginning of this year, there are many parallels with what the Trump administration has done in terms of, you know, lack of enforcement of existing laws, making changes to the regulations and laws to weaken protections of environment, protections of human rights, in the Brazilian case of indigenous rights, and this pattern of essentially putting the worst people to lead different ministries in the case of Brazil. And so putting climate deniers and putting people, the Minister of Environment is essentially an environmental criminal from past activities before he became the minister.
What do you think is most important for the globe right now, the response to what's happening?
Well, there's a lot of things that are important. People need to show their solidarity with indigenous peoples. People should come out in the global mobilizations that are happening around the Amazon, also the climate strikes that are happening in September. And people need to reevaluate their own.
But we'll do part two, put it online. Andrew Miller of Amazon Watch. Very happy birthday to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hope Village Farmers Market has partnered with the Michigan Farmers Market Association, a nonprofit, member-based statewide association on a mission to advance farmers markets to create a thriving marketplace for local food and farm products. For fresh local produce, vegan food, children's activities, beautiful gardens, yoga in the park, and more. Stop by Hope Village Farmers Market at 14150 Woodrow Wilson at Oakland Boulevard, Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m. Visit Facebook.com/MyHopeVillage for more information. Support your local farmers.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College,
this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener supported.
Non-commercial radio.
This is WHFR, the station making waves. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw, Happy New Year, right?
Happy,
I always like to say at the beginning of a new school year, it is a brand new year. So Happy New Year. How about that?
Thank you. Same to you. It really is kind of a reset of, you know, of mind, body, and spirit. And we're so happy to be back and excited to have our inaugural sort of official first of the new school year edition of the WHFR Journal. And lots going on already. We're off and running, huh, Alan?
Even though the you know, the college students and those of us here at HFC are back to work, you know, the kiddies, they still got a few more days, at least some of them, and through Labor Day. So we want to mention something that's going on in terms of a children's activity that's coming up. This is going to be auditions for the musical version of Mary Poppins. Henry Ford College and the Dearborn Recreation Department collaborating a co-production of the family musical, which is going to be taking place in November, the 14th through 24th at various days. And there will be auditions taking place in just a few days. In fact, Monday and Tuesday from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Adrey Auditorium here on the HFC campus, Building F, the McKenzie Fine Arts Building. And obviously, the cast ages range from 5 to 75. You're going to be prepared to sing a few bars of a song of your choice, bring a resume of your previous stage experience, and for more information, you can contact the director of the production, Mary Bremer Beer. Her number is 586- 983-9484.
So much going on, and Mary Poppins is very big right now, so get involved if it pertains to you, if you're interested. So many other ways to get involved, both in our community and in our campus community as well. A little later in our show, we're going to talk with Steve Glazer and Doug Schoquist, representing the Sisson Art Gallery here at HFC. We're going to talk about album cover art, a new exhibition that has just opened on our campus. And just before that, we're going to welcome Christopher Corbin into the studios. He is the grandson and also the founder of the Harley J. Corbin Foundation. Lots going on, and they're changing lives, and we're going to talk about that as well.
I look forward to hearing that.
Very good.
We'll be back with that actually just in a minute or so here on the WHFR Journal.
Are you a local artist? Would you like to hear your music on WHFR? Please send us your music for airplay consideration. You can find our email and physical mailing addresses at whfr.fm. Don't wait. Send your MP3s, CDs, and records today.
This is Sam the Sax Man. Join me every Monday, 2 to 4 p.m. on WHFR 89.3 FM, where we go for a panoramic view of music. I seek to find the story behind the artist and maybe some history that even I or you have not ever heard of about a certain artist. From Mozart to Memphis, the Stone Age to the Stones, crooners, mooners, and sooners in June, I will do my best to bring you quality programming in the tradition of WHFR. Please tune in every Monday, 2 to 4 WHFR, and you can live stream us off of our website. Thank you.
Welcome to the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, and I have a special guest in studio with me. When you hear the last name of Corbin, I think many people in the community go right to the top, right to the man himself, Harley Corbin. One of my pleasures of working at this college is the opportunity to meet so many wonderful people at so many fundraising events and so on. And I'll tell you, meeting Harley Corbin was one of the highlights of the past year, I think, of my life, for sure. Well, now we are going to be chatting with his grandson, Christopher Corbin, to talk a little bit about the inspiration that his grandfather has had on him, and in turn the inspiration it's having and the benefit it's having on so many other people. So we're talking about the Harley J. Corbin Foundation. And Christopher, welcome. So happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Susan. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Certainly. When we talk about sort of the official Harley J. Corbin Foundation, that might be a little bit different than sort of the unofficial thing that's been going on for many, many years.
Correct.
In terms of fundraising to support great causes. But tell us about how the, you know, sort of the history of this, how everything got started, mm-hmm. both officially and even, you know, more length of time unofficially.
Of course. So back in early 1990, I was diagnosed with dyslexia, and my parents were trying to find services for me to take advantage of outside of school to help, because I was really struggling. I was in third grade and I couldn't read. There were no laws like there are today. So I definitely would have been held back. Well, my grandfather at the time was part of the Children's Dyslexia Center, which is now located here in Dearborn. Then it was located downtown Detroit. And I was able to get on the wait list, and I was fortunate enough to receive the opportunity to get a tutor. And when I went in there, I was reading well below my grade level. And when I left the program, like 2.5 years later, I was reading at a college level.
Wow.
So that one-on-one tutoring really changed the whole direction of my life. And now I am currently in a doctoral program. I'm in the second year of my doctoral program.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I finished my master's degree and I have 2 bachelor's degrees. And that was from a kid who was told I really needed to lower my aspirations in life because my learning disability, if it were a real thing, was going to limit me. So after I got out, separated from the Marine Corps, we officially filed paperwork for our 501c3 status. And in April of last year, we received that approval from the IRS. So we went from the foundation raising money for the Children's Dyslexia Center for the past 14 years. We just had our 14th annual golf outing, to where we're now a 501c3 nonprofit foundation that's helping not only children with dyslexia, but children who face neurodevelopmental concerns as well as physical concerns like dyspraxia. So that way it's kind of a more globalized but specific population who is really, I guess, overlooked and underfunded and resourced. So that's what we're hoping to fill.
Wow. Well, that's quite an enormous goal, and but one that is being achieved, as we know.
Yes.
15, you don't have a golf outing 14 years in a row to raise funds without it being incredibly successful. You have some that'll go 2 or 3 years and they kind of fizzle out, but that's anything over 10 years is pretty impressive. And it all comes back to that name, Corbin, in particular, Harley Corbin, your
yes.
grandfather. What is his direct connection to this whole big touchy-feely thing that you got going on?
So my grandpa's always been one for teaching the family to give back to others who are less fortunate or take advantage of the resources and opportunities that we have and try to help those around us become successful. And that's kind of the idea we've taken with this. And in education, he is so passionate about education with all of his children, his grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So it really seemed like the opportunity to take advantage of his desire to help others and his passion for education, and really come to like a culminating event, which is the formation of the official foundation.
Mm, nice. And, you know, oftentimes when foundations become named for somebody else, the person has been gone
Correct.
A while, and they're in spirit. Well, he's here very
yes.
much. Very much.
very
here.
Much
he
so.
Actually was on our radio station last year for
yes.
an interview, and it wasn't that long ago, and just a spark plug, as always. So I know a little bit about his story, sort of not coming from great means, but working very hard in
yes.
a number of capacities to build himself mm-hmm. As a successful entrepreneur and his family. And those values, I'm sure, have carried through because it's not easy to spearhead the starting of a foundation and to actually make it successful. So what you're doing, along with getting your your doctorate degree and so many other things, not an easy thing to do. We have him to thank for some of that, right?
That's 100% correct.
Yeah, very good. How does he feel about all this, the whole namesake and all that?
When we were looking to, we knew we wanted to do something along these lines, and we asked if he'd be comfortable if we named the foundation after him. And he didn't really know what to think at first,
mm-hmm.
But then it came out that he was very, very moved because he's one to sit back and help and observe and do whatever he can for others and not take any credit or not take any thanks for it. He enjoys doing what many people often don't enjoy, is those thankless jobs. So this is one way where we were able to kind of put identification on him and say, hey, this is really for you. You're the inspiration and the motivation behind all this, and we do want to call attention to it because it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. We are talking with Christopher Corbin, grandson of Harley Corbin, namesake of the Harley J. Corbin Foundation. I'd like to learn more about some of the very specific things that people need to know about this foundation, both as potential benefit opportunities for them, but also ways people can help and be a part of the a part of the process of helping and change and so on. I know that your grandfather was not born and raised in this area, West Virginia?
Correct.
Is it? And there's a story kind of behind that whole thing too, I think. Yeah.
Yes. So he was born in West Virginia. They really came from nothing. They were rather destitute. And if it weren't for my great uncle, his older brother, going to join the Marine Corps, which I followed in his mm-hmm. footsteps as well, and then he came home and began to work for a construction, and they eventually moved out of state. That's what pulled my grandfather away, because there was no work in West Virginia and the family was struggling financially. So he knew the only way to support that and have develop his own life were to go and find the work that needed to be done. So he started in that construction business decades ago, and from there he formed numerous companies and made a name for himself and really kind of came from nothing and develop that work ethic that he's instilled in all of us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. The opportunity to sort of flip your life around is one success story, but then branching that out to taking other people's lives and helping
yes.
to flip those around is the second leg of it. You know, that's the inspiring part, twofold
right.
and even more. When we talk about community outreach, training, that kind of stuff, as it relates to the Harley J. Corbin Foundation, Do you need help? Are there, you're looking for physical bodies? Is it financial? What's the deal?
We're really looking for anything that's available. There's a lot of information that's hard to find because it's not a, the areas that we're looking at, like neurodevelopmental, dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, dyspraxia, mm-hmm. they're all very specialized fields and not very many people specialize in them. I'll be going to the APA conference tomorrow, and there's one session out of the entire American Psychological Association annual meeting that talks about dyslexia.
Wow.
And that's a huge population of professionals.
Yeah.
So right now we're really trying to build communication and information that the foundation is out there mm-hmm. and exists. And on our website, we have resources for parents, so that way they know they're not alone. And there's resources that they can go and get support with state laws, state statutes, because those are kind of hard to navigate, especially when they're battling to try and develop a 504 or an IEP for their kid. Mm-hmm. That's really challenging. A lot of people really struggle with that. And as well as support and resources for students, like student resource groups, that they know that they're not alone in the struggle. I talk to a lot of students and parents, and they really think that they are on their own and that there's no help out there. And it's just because there may be a handful of students in one school who are having their own struggles, but they never get to communicate with each other, when there's hundreds of thousands of students all over the nation who are having those same battles. So just letting people know that there's other out there going through what they're going through, that really instills a sense of hope.
When you talk about any of the disses, you mentioned a couple that I am familiar with, but then you mentioned some that I've never heard of before.
Yeah, of course.
Go through those, the different, I think there are four that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm. So dyslexia, dysgraphia, and dyscalculia, they fall under neurodevelopmental, and then there's a lot of disses in
there. Yeah.
dyspraxia is more of a, they call it developmental motor coordination. I don't remember what the actual DSM diagnosis is.
Okay.
But it's affects speech, writing, coordination, mobility in students. So one is very neurodevelopmental in terms of like academics, students struggle, and the other can impair academic and daily life.
Okay. In terms of cures, causes, medications, those types of things,
It's a great question.
Yeah.
A lot of students who are diagnosed with specific learning disabilities is kind of what those mm-hmm. lump under, or delayed motor development. They're diagnosed a lot of often with ADHD, and they're medicated for ADHD. But again, that doesn't really get to what the root cause is, or more specifically, how those students can be helped through alternative learning methods. And unfortunately, the schools just don't have the time or the resources to develop those individual plans that the students really need. And that's the hardest part.
Okay. Yeah, it's often, I think, we don't hear about these until somebody famous comes out and
right.
admitting, Tom Cruise, Cher, back in my day, and then that was how I learned about even what dyslexia was. But I would assume that being able to come up with the diagnosis is half the battle.
It is.
And then knowing how to treat it.
And that was one thing that we really have a big passion for, is raising funds to help families offset the cost of testing, because a lot of times educational testing is not covered by insurance. Mm. So we have a lot of students. I'm the chairman of the board for the Learning Center now, and we have a lot of parents who pay $3,000 to $4,000 for testing just to get their student diagnosed with the actual diagnosis of dyslexia, because without that, they can't get services at school, or even diagnosed with a specific learning disorder. They're not able to do those IEPs or to get additional time or resources. So that's the first big hurdle.
Yeah. When you say you're chair of the board of the Learning Center, explain the Learning Center.
So the Learning Center, it's the Children's Dyslexic Learning Center of Southeastern Michigan.
Okay.
It's located right off of Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn. And that's where the tutor that I went to is still there. But mm-hmm. that's the center I went to for specifically dyslexia. They use an Orton-Gillingham approach, which is evidence-based, the most effective way to instruct a student with dyslexia. And they use a bunch of different methods and means, but it's one-on-one tutoring, one tutor, one student, and they sit there and work through the lessons plans that the center director comes up with.
Okay.
So right now our wait list is about a year long.
Wow.
But we're getting three new tutors, and we're always looking for additional tutors who are interested in being trained by our center director and becoming a tutor on the side as well.
Okay. The mission or the philosophy of the Harley J. Corbin Foundation, and I, looking on your website, saw so many wonderful stories and, you know, paragraphs about different things, but the opportunity to provide financial support, time, resources, just a network for other parents, mm-hmm. a network for other students, all of those are just amazing aspirational goals, and your grandfather is very aspirational, so
yes.
it makes sense. But I love this one line, so I want to just share this. It says, our aspirational goal for the Harley J. Corbin Foundation is to build a society where learning disorders and educational barriers are not only viewed as legitimate, but to foster a better understanding on how we can help these individuals achieve their goals. That's very profound. And the idea of having to fight to get something to be viewed as legitimate in this day and age kind of blows my mind.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that challenge.
So that really came from my experience as a student, where in elementary school, the parapro, or not the parapro, the special education teacher, she told me and my parents that dyslexia was not a real diagnosis, so I didn't need to seek services for something that didn't exist. Mm. And if I were to just stay in school and, again, lower those goals, then I'd be okay. I'd at least graduate or get a certificate of completion, it was. Mm. But so that was one person's opinion who could have definitely swayed my entire life experience afterwards.
Yeah. And that's a person in a position where we would expect they would have all of the knowledge,
right,
and the,
yes,
and the latest information and the resources. So that could have been quite a roadblock.
Yes.
But fortunately, you and your family decided to push through and try other opportunities.
Yes. If my family weren't, we'll say, strong-willed enough to go against that guidance and seek help, then I wouldn't be where I am today. And unfortunately, there's a lot of families that don't or can't stand up for that, mm-hmm. or don't feel confident enough, and they get pushed to the side.
Yeah.
And it really harms the student, who's the one who needs the support the most.
What are the symptoms at this phase when we define dyslexia? What are the things that are happening that are different than a normal learning opportunity? I hate to use the word normal.
Totally understand.
It's typical, I guess.
Yeah. So, like, atypical things you would see when you think of dyslexia, a lot of people equate that to Percy Jackson, because he was mm-hmm. dyslexic, so he could read Greek. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I'll still even get letters backwards or words backwards. It's a very similar thing, or reversed D's and B's. Just not being able to phonetically sound out the word. And that's the hardest part, is it affects each student differently. So there are general diagnoses, qualifications or standards that they would meet, but it's hard because one student may not have the same as five or six others, or it may impact them slightly different, or they may have more of a problem with comprehension but still have dyslexia, to where it's not always an easy case.
So those are sort of the concrete things that might be happening to the mind, to the brain. But then when we talk about sort of that next layer, which are sort of the psychological things, when mm-hmm. you've got these challenges and in a classroom environment you're perceived as just not being able to read, or you're not being able to follow the other students or get it done quickly enough, mm-hmm. or whatever, then there's that layering of, oh, you're not smart enough, you're not good enough,
yes.
You got to be in this group, and we have to make a new group for you because you're not fitting in with the other ones.
Exactly.
Is it the case where students are just trying to hide it, maybe, trying to just find a spot in there somewhere and not call attention?
There is definitely the element of students trying to... It's amazing how somebody can use their social skills to cope with different things, mm. Which is a lot what these students do. More often or not, it's the students that are distracted. So they're distracted. There comes that ADHD, is they're distracted a lot of the time. But it's because they just can't get the material. They can't click into what's being taught. So, yeah, if I'm disconnected in a classroom, I'm going to kind of gaze out the window or let the imagination go. And that's what makes it difficult. That's why so many students get co-diagnosed or comorbid diagnoses of ADHD and specific learning disorders.
I see. When you started going to a tutor, at what point did something finally click or kick in for you? What was your experience like?
So I remember to this day walking down the hallway in elementary school looking at my feet because I was afraid to talk to any of the students that would walk by me because I didn't feel like I had anything to contribute because I didn't feel like I was intelligent enough to be with my peers. And after going to the Learning Center, I got more confidence, and it's amazing that self-confidence and that ability to know that you are not dumb or you are not stupid. Like those words are very powerful, and they take a huge hit on the confidence of an individual. But we were reading The Secret of NIM, mm-hmm. and I still read a little bit slower than my peers now, which is that's totally fine. But everybody was reading so fast in class, and I knew the answer to something the teacher had asked because I had read the book because I was able to do that on my own. So I just shouted out, I was like, wait a minute. And the whole class got quiet. And I talked my thought process out after reading the book and answered the question. And the teacher looked at me because she knew the struggles I was going through. And she was like, that is completely correct. Great job. So that was like a peak experience mm-hmm. in life. And that was, I'll never forget, The Secret of NIM.
Wonderful. I got chills, goosebumps hearing that story. Yay, love it. That's the goal. You know, it's that connectedness. It's that opportunity for families to feel that they're not alone, that there are options, that there are ways to improve upon what's going on. And the Harley J. Corbin Foundation is certainly a catalyst to make those things happen. When you talk about opportunities to do more of what this foundation is set up to do, I imagine fundraising is a big portion of it, like the golf outing, et cetera.
Yes.
You got some other things going on?
We do. We have a couple events coming up in September, actually. We do have a fundraiser at Senate Coney Island to where on our Facebook page or our website, they can download the brochure or the flyer, and they show it to the restaurant, and the Senate is going to donate 15% of the bills to the foundation. So it's no extra cost to the individual. It's just something the restaurant's doing, and that's kind of a lot of the fundraisers we have set up. Like that one is September 18th at the Senate Coney Island in Dearborn. And that's really, we wanted to include as many people without taking any burden from them because we know not everybody is able to do that. And we want to support that because a lot of our students are also in low socioeconomic classes. And we see that struggle a lot. Parents not only being able to struggle with their own means in life, but getting the additional resources to help their child. It's heart-wrenching to watch that struggle happen. So we want to incorporate families into all of our events, which is why a lot of them are at places where they come and eat. A lot of people go out and eat anyway, so if they're going to do that, we might as well target those events right now and build up our awareness and then start to branch out and do our community training events for teachers and administrators, professionals, and families.
Nice. Are you partnering with any other organizations? Have people reached out from other groups, organizations, school districts, anything like that? Or is the official 501c3 designation sort of so fresh that that's kind of not started yet?
So we are currently trying to reach out to other community partners like the public school districts mm-hmm. as well as other businesses in the area to help again build awareness and kind of build sponsorship opportunities and that important relationship, that networking opportunity, mm-hmm. because word by mouth is a very powerful thing. And the networking we understand is completely important, especially in this day and age. So right now we are still fresh, but we're approaching a lot of individuals to see if there's the opportunity to work in partnership.
Nice. And Christopher, you are, as you said, getting your PhD, what do you want to do in this next, once that part's done, when it really kicks in, what is your goal?
So I'll be graduating in 2022 with my PsyD. Mm-hmm. It's a doctorate in clinical psychology. And I hope to work specifically in health psychology, along with the VA, because I am myself a veteran, but also manage this foundation with more of a clinical aspect and kind of grow this foundation into a fully functioning group to where we can really provide resources and testings and kind of full services to students, families, and teachers, because all three of those elements are so important, students, families, and teachers. Without one of them, it doesn't work.
That makes good sense. If someone wants to learn more, they're intrigued with this interview, they know Harley, maybe, and yeah. they're like, I didn't know that this existed, or just want to get some good information, maybe make a donation, whatever. How can they reach you? How can they reach out to the Harley J. Corbin?
We do have an independent website. It's the Harley J. Corbin, the HJCFoundation.com. So our website is the hjcfoundation.com. And there's opportunities on there. It has our calendar events. It has the blogs that I do, just information on events or new partnerships that we may have come up with. But we also have a Facebook page, because most people are on Facebook, which is the HJC Foundation. And then we also have Snapchat and Twitter, too. So, again, it's all the HJC Foundation, to keep it all same across the board.
Yeah, easy enough. Great. Mm-hmm. If you had one piece of advice, one thing that you absolutely want to make sure gets out to our WHFR listeners on our show today, what would that be?
It would be that we have a growing list of resources on our website that are completely free, because the information that's out there should be available to our students and our teachers and our parents, because the battle, it's not an independent battle. They may feel alone and isolated, but there's support, there's love, and there's understanding. And that's really what we're here for, is to allow that opportunity for people to connect to one another and be that community of support.
Well, thank you. I am sure that your grandfather is very proud of you, not to sound condescending, but I can only imagine how he beams. So this legacy that he's leaving and still participating in actively,
yes.
I'm sure,
yes.
is one that, you know, I'm sure he knows it's in such good hands and will be here for many, many, many years to come. So we thank you for your commitment and dedication to this cause, as well as the entire Corbin family and Harley himself. We'll have to get him in again sometime real soon, but because he's just a blast to talk to with the Exchange Club, of course,
yes.
and other things. But just, you know, so tied to the community. But this is it. You don't have to have $1 zillion and be born with that silver spoon to make that kind of an impact and create that kind of a legacy, but this is proof that that hard work and a passion and an interest is certainly something that will pay off. We thank you for your time. Continued success. Good luck to you with everything you're working on.
Thank you, Susan. We really do appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. And again, the HJC
Foundation. .com.
Perfect. Thank you. We have more to come. Please stay with us. This is the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. And don't touch that dial.
Why is my son having trouble in school?
Finding lowest airfare to Istanbul.
No, I'm tired of fighting with my son over his homework.
Home, walk, restaurant, need a review?
No, he's smart, but his mind wanders.
Seven wonders of the world.
Why don't you understand me?
I do. I was trying to show how Connor feels every day. Redirecting to understood.org.
Join parents and experts at understood.org, a free online resource about learning and attention issues to help your child thrive.
Brought to you by understood.org and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. So pleased to be with you this Friday afternoon, along with Susan McGraw. And one of the great things about, you know, coming back for a new school year is that we have, you know, familiar faces that we see, and we have new faces that we may not know that much about and want to learn a little bit more about. So I think in this segment we have one of each, right?
We absolutely do, Alan, and thank you. Welcome back to you as well. So happy to be here with you, our WHFR Journal listeners, and so excited to be joined in studio with a couple of fellas that are going to really, really, I think, pique our interest when it comes to both art and music, two of our very favorite things here at WHFR. We think of music as an art form, but we're talking about the visual art as well as the audible or audio art. So we're going to talk about an exhibit that's coming up here, actually just opened yesterday at the Sisson Gallery here on our campus at Henry Ford College. And coincidentally, it's called Album Cover Art, A Window on World Cultures and Art History. And as I understand it, this is 100 framed album covers and 60 framed informational pieces arranged into some different categories. But since I don't know much beyond what I just said, we brought in the experts. Alan, what do you think about that?
I would love to hear more about it. Of course, you know, in the digital age, we don't really have that, like, tactile, you know, physical piece of, you know, cardboard in front of us with a piece of artwork on it. You just have a little, you know, icon on your phone. I know, I miss that, don't
I? I do, too.
Okay,
I always make my son, when he's listening to something, streaming something on his phone, I'm like, wow, look at that cute little postage stamp size picture. Is that the album? And I make it blow it up for me, and then it's only 2 inches by 1 inch, but at least it's a little bigger. And, but yeah, we missed that stuff.
Yeah, apparently we're not the only ones, because I think that's probably a lot of what goes into the concept of this this exhibition.
Yeah, it really is a part of the full package when experiencing a musical collection. It,
it
has been forever, and
we grew up on it.
Yeah, we did.
and with
albums coming back, thankfully, we are seeing more album art, and we can talk about some of the very new and very modern interpretations of that, but this exhibit talks a bit about history. So let me introduce our guest. You recognize probably who just spoke, and that was Steve Glazer, who is a faculty member here at our college and director coordinator of the Sisson Gallery, which is located on our main campus at Henry Ford College, and it's in the Fine Arts Building, the Fine Arts Center. Beautiful gallery, and always bringing in cutting-edge opportunities for experiential art, in fact. And Doug Schoquist is here as well. And Doug is he's the brains behind this particular operation when it comes to this exhibit. So we look forward to learning more, fellas. Steve, you said we grew up on album art, and we really did.
Yeah.
I remember buying albums because I liked what it looked like,
often,
as opposed to
often.
The album
itself.
It's like
you didn't know the music, and it's like you just, it's like, well, this looks cool, or this looks challenging or different than anything. It's like, maybe it's worth the exploration.
Yeah.
And especially when you start finding stuff in cutout bins or used bins, it's like, oh, this looks cool. Buck, sure, I'll buy.
Thank you for that, by the way. Yeah, homecoming was a success, so thanks to you in part. But when we think about the art as an extension of the musical form that's in the sleeve, right, mm-hmm. in the jacket, I suppose that's one interpretation, because oftentimes artists themselves work with particular musicians, particular bands, performers, etc., because there's a sort of a connection, a kindred spirit, if you will. And I'm curious as to how long that's been happening. And how often maybe that exists. And so really glad we've got Doug here to tell us a little bit about sort of the concept of album art and its interpretation and its meaning, and then also some specifics about this particular exhibit and what our guests are going to see. So what do you think, Doug?
Yeah, this is everything you've been saying is absolutely true. You know, now you can download your favorite music on iTunes or whatever and never see any art. And so, you know, we miss that. And, you know, you've lost a venue for aesthetic enjoyment. And, you know, in the old days, during the 60s and 70s, the artwork on album covers and the music, they were taken together. It was like, you know, it was taken like a pill, you know, like it increased the efficacy of both of them. Mm. So, that's part of the impetus of doing this kind of an exhibit, is that we miss the aesthetic enjoyment that we got out of the album cover.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that you're embracing this.
Don't you think, I'm going to ask a question that I didn't think about before, that as the exhibition starts, which is, 1967 or so, mm-hmm. that was the coming of age of so many artist-turned-musicians,
yes.
Especially in England.
Yes, especially in England.
Yeah. It's like, we forget that it's like, yeah, half the Beatles. It's like Keith Richards, Eric Clapton, Ian Anderson. All these people were in art school.
Yeah. And Pete Townsend as well.
Yeah, Townsend. Pete Townsend, Ron Wood.
Yeah, mm-hmm. John Entwistle.
Yeah, John Mayall. These were all visual
art students
before they happened to make a big playing music.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, this is pre-Woodstock, you know, when it mm-hmm. starts, 1967. Great year, by the way. Best year ever. and this, you start there and you work all the way up to 1983, as I understand.
Yeah.
What? Why that time span?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that one, actually. It's a good question. Listen, 1967 represents a turning point in the whole theme of album cover artwork. And, it implies, of course, that the stuff that was on album covers prior to 1967 is very, very different from what we have from 67 to 83. And then from 1983, we're going back to portrait photography, like what you had on the pre-1967 stuff. So what makes the interior of this chronological framework, 67 to 83, is there's a de-emphasis on photography and a celebration of artwork. So you're going to have a lot of artwork during this time frame that is oil on canvas. You know, we're going back to these traditional art forms and art mediums, collages, woodcut.
Yeah.
Woodcut. And then you have some of the newer things like airbrushing. And it just created this unparalleled era of album cover artwork. So I kind of think of that 1967 and 1983 as a golden age time frame.
Well, give us a few examples of maybe some of the, you know, album covers that you're talking about. Some of them maybe we know, some of them maybe we don't know.
Well, if you look at, let's try 1965, if you look at the Beatles' 6 album,
mm-hmm.
then that comes out in 1965. What comes out in 1967 is Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Mm-hmm. Very different idea on the album cover. If you look at the Rolling Stones,
that's what I was going to mention.
Out of Our Heads, I think it is, right? 1965.
Out of Our Heads. Photograph
yeah.
of the four or the
yeah,
five.
Yeah, just photographs.
A really
just
good like photograph, the though,
but
by the
yeah.
way.
But it's a photograph, and yeah, then you think of right. Satanic Majesty's Request.
Yeah. There you go. That's a perfect example.
And then we move into, you know, Pink Floyd, probably, and, you know, even into the 70s, you know, bands like Boston, where you don't really have, you know, the band on the cover. I don't know if that's, right. you know, one of the ones you're talking about, but just, you know, what certainly an album most people will know the cover of.
Yeah, the science
where
fiction.
It's, yeah, creating this universe, and the music stuff. Is a part of it.
Yeah, very true.
I think some of the best ones, or maybe I should say some of the most popular or maybe most overdone ones, we see on T-shirts. A lot mm-hmm. these days, and we said, and we find them on people's walls as posters and so on and so forth. So how deep are we digging with this particular exhibit? Are we going to recognize, you know, those of us that were from this era, you know, are we going to recognize most of these, as Alan was asking, or do you think that there are going to be some surprises that we might learn about for the first time? Because I'm guessing it's not all American, clearly not all American yeah. projects.
There's some surprises, because there's some I didn't know. And that takes a lot.
Yeah. It takes some doing to go through the exhibit itself, you know, and if you read all the material in there and everything. But, you know, there's going to be some surprises. There's going to be some familiar imagery that you've seen before on T-shirts and posters, of course. But, you know, I think there's going to be some surprises. And one of the big surprises is going to be that you're going to find a lot of artwork from art history that all of a sudden showed up on album covers during this time frame. So you're going to get Renaissance artists, you're going to get the Romanticists, you're going to get the Surrealists, you know, Magritte and Dali. You're going to get Rockwell, you know, on a few album covers, things like that, Andy Warhol, of course. So it really spans a lot of different art movements like postmodernism and primitivism, romanticism, surrealism, Renaissance stuff. All of that shows up there. And I think one of the unintended consequences of this album art that came out during this golden age was that it introduced a young audience to a lot of art history, and they didn't, you know, they weren't aware or interested in, you know, these trends. And I think that's also true about world civilizations. You know, one of the other themes that we deal with in this art exhibit is world cultural themes. And so you're going to have a lot of Asian themes that are in the content of the album art, and African themes, and European and themes from the Americas. So I think, you know, that's just an unintended consequence of this artwork. They gave us a tour of the global village, so to speak, you know, in the 1960s when we're not really aware of what's going on somewhere else.
So there's an academic side to this.
Yeah, and, well, and I'm going to interject some. We have to take in mind that Doug Schoquist, sitting to my left, is a retired world cultures teacher at Lansing Community College. So there is that awareness of. But what is really neat about this exhibition is not only seeing the albums, but seeing the commentary about the artist and the art. Because on each one, each tag is labeled with the artist who did the work for that cover. So it's, you know, you start seeing some, you know, names that pop up in different places throughout the exhibition, and some that you're very familiar with, and some that it's like, you know, who in the world is this? Or, wow, I never noticed that this was from this, and type things like that. There's a lot of that.
So there'll be some surprises for people when they go in there.
All right. I'm interested that you talked about sort of the way the exhibit is going to be laid out. You said you mentioned the sort of three sections or three phases. Mm-hmm. So just kind of going through those, the golden age of mm-hmm. album cover art, which we talked about, and then window on world cultures, and then finally a window on art history. So it's sort of a three-part experience, yes?
The intro part of it, the golden age part of it, provides a context for the rest of the show. And so the world, you know, the world civilizations part of it, the world cultural parts, you're going to find a lot of imagery that has to do with dragons, for example. You've got Hindu themes, Buddhist themes, Chinese themes. You got ukiyo-e, you know, Japanese themes, for example. So you get all that. And I think that the exhibit has a teaching component to it. Africa, you're going to find, you know, artwork by Maddie Clarvine, who does a lot of stuff with the Wota Abe nomads of Niger. Pyramids, of course, show up on album cover artworks all the time. So I think, you know, that is, for me, a really exciting part of this exhibit. I think that for young people during this time frame, it kind of provided some enlightenment about world cultures.
I think it did when we weren't even realizing
it. We didn't realize it. I don't think so, yeah.
That's often the way it works, though, isn't it?
But it got me interested in it. You know, that's how I got started getting into world civilizations was, where is this? You know, Wota Abe nomads, where are they from?
Or what's going on with Santana? Yeah. Where's this being from?
It's like, what is this? Clarvine's artwork, you know, and he lived with them. So the artist who did the artwork, so...
So these albums, are these, you know, kind of like from personal collection or things you've hunted down to find, you know, the most pristine, version of the album cover? And I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're going to be looking at the actual album covers, not prints or enlargements of them, correct?
Actual.
Okay. Actual album covers that are all framed.
From your collection or what has been your journey to try and find ones that you're interested in?
A lot of them I've had myself. And then, you know, you track down, but, you know, one thing leads to another. And so you find that, wow, this is a Norman Rockwell painting. And then you say, I wonder if he did any other ones for Columbia Records. And sure enough, he did. So it kind of works that way. Maddie Clarvine is another real prolific. He's probably the most prolific besides Roger Dean, the album cover artist. So, you know, it goes from point A to point B. You start looking at all of these artists that are doing this artwork, and you come up with some big surprises.
What was one of the hardest ones that you wanted to have to find, and where did you find it?
Yeah, a controversial one, actually, and it's not in the exhibit, but the first Moby Grape album, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a controversial one where they had to air out one of the musicians was giving the finger, you know. So they airbrushed that out. But, you know, that was probably the hardest one to get, and it was the most expensive one to get. Most of them, you know, I just get them online, or I go to record stores and buy them for $8 to $10, or I think probably the most I ever paid for an album cover was maybe $50.
And most of us, when we go to record stores, we're pulling the album out of the sleeve and looking at the quality of the vinyl.
See if it's scratched.
You might be coming from a different perspective.
Yeah,
I
could care less what's in the inside. I throw them out sometimes, or I give them to my brother.
There you go. You can always donate them here, by the way. FYI.
I could do
new
that.
New tip for you. Well, we're talking with Steve Glazer and Doug Schoquist about the newly opened exhibit at the Sisson Gallery here on our wonderful HFC campus. It's called Album Cover Art, A Window on World Cultures and Art History. Doug, to piggyback on Alan's last question, you've been collecting these pieces and you've been putting this together. When we talk about the framed sort of information pieces that are arranged mm-hmm. with the art, was that all your research? Did you have collaboration? What are we going to see when it comes to that? And how long has it taken you to put this together to finally exhibit it? Or is it moving around? Are we a stop on a trip for you?
Stop. It's been around. It's just a traveling exhibit.
Great.
And I started to get serious about doing an exhibit probably in the middle 1990s. when I had, you know, enough money to buy records and spend some time doing this kind of research. And in 1998, I was on sabbatical at Lansing Community College, and they allowed me to produce and write a video documentary on album cover artwork. So that kind of got it really moving from an academic standpoint, and from there it's just snowballed. So I'm hoping that I have a lot of material that's written up into a study, and hopefully it'll get published or something one of these days. It takes time.
Yeah. How important is it that, you know, the image that you see on the cover is reflected in the music? I mean, are there, you know, album covers, Doug, that, you know, were just awesome as visual, but the music was kind of not so great, that don't meet the level, or is it just simply looking at the cover?
For me, it's looking at the cover. But I'll tell you, you know, Steve and I talked about this today a little bit. You know, I mean, one of my favorite album covers is Tales from Topographic Oceans, you know, by Yes. Mm-hmm. But the music in there just doesn't capture me the same way that earlier Yes albums did. And so, you know, and if you ask me about the music that's in a lot of the album covers that I have in the exhibit, I couldn't tell you one song that came off of it. So I'm definitely doing this from an art history or artist standpoint. I am a musician also, but, you know, so in the old days I'd buy the albums because I needed to learn the songs for the band that we were playing in. But, you know, then it just became an obsession with the artwork. And I think that there's a parallel with this. You know, back in the 18th century and early 19th centuries in Japan, people would buy woodblock prints. And I started to see, because I know a lot about Japanese culture, and I started to see a similarity between this very affordable and collectible art form, album cover art, and woodblock prints. So,
well, when we talk about a newer generation being introduced to not only vinyl albums to begin with, because some of them have never held one, you know, in their lives, I cringe when I see somebody pick up an album and they're just like all handsy all over it. But between that and the artwork, I hate to admit it, but I have purchased some very new artists' music because of the album art, just absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Kanye West's latest album, just spectacular artwork, just unbelievable. Not to mention going into some of the hip hop culture where they're willing to take some more risks and interpret some things really uniquely. But those do tend to, I think, very much represent the music. You know, the music that's inside. And I'm thinking of the British band, the Arctic Monkeys, and they have some really interesting and unique pieces of beautiful art on their albums, again, reflective of what's happening inside, you know, inside those sleeves. But so I wonder if the trend is, as new people are getting introduced to arts albums in general, I wonder if there's a purposeful effort to make that connection more so than there was in the period that you talk about, the Golden Age.
I think during that golden age that the musicians had a little bit more say-so in what goes on the album cover. So, you know, for example, the Beatles, when they did Sgt. Pepper's, there's four of the six Hindu gurus on there from Self-Realization Fellowship. And George Harrison had a lot to do with that as well. But a lot of the music and some of the artwork, if you look at Jimi Hendrix's Axis Bold as Love album cover, it's filled with Hindu images. And, you know, so there's a lot of that that's going on there. There's a lot of more input, I think, by the artists, even though that album cover was a little bit controversial, because they asked Jimi Hendrix, they said, well, what would you like on the album cover? And he says, just give me something Indian. And so when David Law and Roger King or David King came back with the album cover and showed him this Hindu imagery, he was disappointed in it because he was thinking it would be American Indian because he's half Cherokee, I think. But it was all Hindu images. But it's a great album cover, whether he liked it or not. But, you know, that's the kind of stories you get.
Yeah, interesting. Ellen, do you have a favorite?
I was going to say, everybody's got a favorite. I didn't want to go first. I kind of wanted to put it to our guests and the experts on the subject, so maybe we can work our way around the room before I have a chance to think of mine. Obviously, everyone's got a favorite. Do you have one, Steve?
Probably thinking, and I hadn't thought about it this way, but looking through the collection that's in the gallery, and albums that stand out to me for their cover have been, probably Sgt. Pepper's, Satanic Majesties, some Santana, some Miles Davis, and another band that I mentioned to you, Gentle Giant.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Doug, you got one?
You know what? People have asked me that a million times.
Yeah, I was going to. I'm sure. Yeah.
I really don't have a favorite album. Comes with the job.
No? Yeah. Okay.
I'll tell you why, though. It's the same with music. I mean, I'll be listening to Sonny Boy Williamson or something like that riding around the car, and the next day I'll be mad about something listening to War Pigs by Black Sabbath. Mm-hmm. So it just goes back and forth. And
that's a lot of how I am.
Yeah, it just depends on the mood, but I do like certain artists. I like Shusei Nagaoka, who did the Starship Spitfire album, and a couple of the Earth, Wind, and Fire album covers. I like Roger Dean, of course, and my favorite artist of all is going to be Matty Clarvine, who did many Santana albums and others.
We started off talking about how, early on, album covers were photographs. They were promoting the band rather than an artistic statement of themselves. Okay, so I'll start with one which is a photograph, which to me is obvious, which would be London Calling by The Clash. Mm-hmm. But probably as far as an artwork, I would go with, and I'm a, obviously musical omnivore, I would say Sketches of Spain by Miles Davis, which I think is just a beautiful piece of art in and of itself.
Very nice. Boy, and this doesn't necessarily reflect my favorite taste in music.
Fair enough, exactly. Right. Yeah, no, it doesn't have to, and that's the whole point of the exhibition,
right,
I assume.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I, for some reason, I'm always drawn to Journey's album covers.
Mm.
I like the Van Halen 5150, especially. I think that's really
nice
cool and just mm-hmm. different. But moving into a newer, more modern era, I mentioned the Arctic Monkeys a little bit ago. I think it's their fifth or sixth album, and I should know that.
The one with
the
waveform on it?
AM, yeah, it's just
right?
AM is
amplitude
all it is.
Amplitude and modulation,
exactly,
I think is what it stands for.
I have to say, that is always my go-to, because
it's very simple.
Think it's so cool. And black and white, and just, it says so much without really saying, much at all. It's simplicity. So those would be my favorites. But I think as people experience this, it's just going to raise these questions.
Yeah.
And isn't that what it's all about?
No, it is.
Well, and I think as people go through one, they may want to find some of these. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You'll find samples of some of the music, if by no other way. It's like, go on their phone or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, who are these people?
Yeah.
And we also have, for people, just a reminder of what it was like to play records. There's a turntable in this display case. And I happened to stumble upon, several years ago, a couple of picture discs in a... in a bargain bin, brand new. And so one of them's on the turntable.
Mm. Very nice.
David Bowie's Hunky Dory.
Nice.
Cool.
Very good one.
I was in a hotel in Chicago a month or so ago, a little cool little boutique hotel. I can't remember the name of it, but they had a record player with an album on it there for you to play.
Yeah.
It was like blues and jazz. They had a few extra albums there, and we used it. I mean, did it sound great?
Cool.
No, but it was very cool, right?
I was at a conference in Baltimore over the summer, and in the hotel lobby, there was a bunch of old jazz albums and a turntable.
A turntable, yeah. Well, and Ellen, should we tell our guests what's under door number three here?
We've got a turntable, so maybe we'll as we wrap up the segment, maybe we'll have a little crackle and pop and some vinyl that we'll listen to.
I love it, gentlemen. Tell us a little bit about when and how we can experience this exhibition individually.
The exhibition is up from through now, the opening of school, through the end of September. Actually, it goes through Henry Ford College's Discover Day, which is the morning of Friday, September 27th, and the exhibition will be taken down that afternoon. So through the month of September.
And Doug, in terms of an opportunity for guests to meet you, are you doing any kind
yes,
of...
Yes, I would be available to do any guest lectures in
nice.
The classroom, for example. So I think, whatever comes up is fine with me. I've done a lot of time in classroom for this exhibit.
Great. So again, album cover art, A Window on World Cultures and Art History at our Sisson Art Gallery here on the HFC campus. Steve, what's the best point of contact for people for more information?
For more information, give me a call at 313-845-6485.
Steve Glazer, Doug Schoquist, thanks so much for joining us on today's edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw, it's great to be back into the swing of things here, right?
Feels good, doesn't
Excellent.
It?
And we got a good soundtrack to lead us out for this edition of the WHFR Journal. We'll be back next week. WHFR has brand new buttons, and we want you to have one for free. We are going old school with this promotion. Simply send us a postcard. Yeah, a real-life postcard with your name and address to WHFR Attention Buttons, 5101 Evergreen Road, Dearborn, Michigan, 48128. Let us know if you like blue or black better. Sounds of creative improvised music continue to wreak havoc over the airwaves. Now on Tuesdays from 7 until 10 p.m. right here at Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR Dearborn.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.